how to obtain access equations in a way that we can then exploit in a numerical evolution. So just trying to recall a few things, and I'm going to mention the notes that we have in the web page are sufficiently thorough, so I suggest you guys try to go through them. I'm just going to pick up a few examples there, try to work them through so that you see how one goes about solving these problems. This is just too loud. And then we'll go through the main results. So we're going to be discussing these relationships, the Gauss-Kodaty relationships. Usually people forget there was a guy named Mainardi that also had something to do with this. So I'm just putting it there for completeness. Let's try to then use the basic infrastructure we've discussed to try to relate things in a four-dimensional manifold as together with the what one could measure with respect to intrinsic properties of given hypersurfaces that we embed into that four-dimensional manifold, and how that manifold, this three-dimensional manifold, is embedded. So the first thing we want to know is that, okay, remember, given this hypersurface sigma, we're imagining that the hypersurface is endowed with the metric GAB. And as a true differential manifold, we're allowed to compute anything we want. So in particular, we can define the Riemann tensor. Here I'm going to just, whenever it's needed, I'm going to put a subindex 3 or superindex 3 to denote this is related to that. Because I'm going to be using tensors that are going to be purely spatial tensors, but as seen from the four-dimensional point of view, I'm going to keep using the Latin indices, so this is to be seen as going from 0 all the way to 4, but in reality, if we put any 0 in here, we get a 0. So this makes absolute sense with respect to the spatial indices that we assign to that manifold, the submanifold, but I want to keep these indices full so that I can relate easily things in the four-dimensional point of view than in the three-dimensional point of view. So by definition, this simply acting, say, on a covector that is purely spatial, that leaves on the manifold sigma. And we're going to try now to do is relate this to what we would measure or we would calculate from the four-dimensional point of view. It's just going to go by steps. And so let me take one of these first. So this is the same as, of course, as the anti-symmetrized derivatives, covariant derivatives acting on WD. So let's just pick one of them and write down explicitly what this should be. And now we're going to begin to relate quantities in the three manifold to those in the four manifold. So by definition, this is equal to so here, when we ignore the DA, we have something that has two indices. This, with respect to the four-dimensional point of view, requires two projectors. These are, sorry, I'll write an H like this, acting on these guys. It should be D. Now, when this acts and we have three indices, we have to project all of them. So I have these three in here. And now we want to compute the whole thing. So we're going to have different contributions. One is where, say, this one acts on this piece, and then when this one acts on the individual one. So I'm doing Leibniz on this second derivative. So we're gonna, this is equal to that's the first term. Then we have that's the second term. And then we have a third one. W in the very beginning.
Yeah, the three the ribbon is acting on W, right?
Yes. Thanks.
Yeah, but then the C is the
free. That should be
you should
C.
Yeah.
I'm calling this. This should be C. I'm using that. I'm using this projector to take care of that. That projector. Okay. Now I'm going to discuss now the kind of the first what each term gives, and then we decide what we do with them. So let me now notice a few things. So if we consider the following combination. Which appears in the second and third terms. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to replace these guys by what we know. These are combinations of the metric G and the N's. Right, when this, so this is, well, sorry, this is D. So this has, I'm going to put a G, GD plus NG, ND, right? So when the covariant derivative acts on the G, we get a zero. And then we have the covariant derivative acting on this combination. And so this is use the fact that when it acts on the first one, I have a zero, when it acts, and then I only have the second one. Now, in the second one, I can have two terms, one when the covariant derivatives have act on NG, or when it acts on ND. But if when it acts on ND, we pull out an NG, and the NG is projected, so we get a zero. Right? Remember, the projector acting on the normal vector is zero. The projector projects on the spatial hypersurface. So that term doesn't contribute when NG comes out. So this is equal to okay, so now we have another expression for grad C of NG, which is in terms of the extrinsic curvature and ends. So this is equal to
Sorry.
Yes.
I didn't understand what happened to the other derivative.
Right, so I have two derivatives, right? And when grad acts on this, I have right. But we have this guy in front. That's a projector. The G is contracting with the G, and that's a zero. But let me just check one thing. BG. BG. All right. Doing G and D. I got something wrong. So this, I wanted to have an F here. Let me just consider this one. Okay, so now we get to this point, and now we have again, this is contracting DNF, so we get a zero, so this term goes away for a single reason. So this is equal to. With a minus sign in front. And the last thing we notice is that remember KFG was a purely spatial tensor. And we're projecting on the spatial direction, on the spatial, on the hypersurface. So these guys would not do anything. So these are just the identities. The only thing this does is to change its indices to A and B. Okay, so now that's one thing we notice, and the other thing we want to know. So every now and then I write H instead of the index like T on their way. Sometimes I write these for H, they're supposed to be the same. So sorry, if I at some point I write an H, this is what I'm trying to do. So I keep going back and forth between that notation and my previous notation. So, suppose I want to deal with this term now. This is the term I would have to deal with if inside here I have that. So if I'm trying to do the grad of this, again by the same argument, I can write down explicitly what that is, which is going to be the GKE plus NK and E. Again, grad, when it acts on this one, gives me a zero. The only thing that is left is this piece. And that shows up in the third term. Okay, we do the same thing. This is the same argument. The grad will act on this one or that one. When it acts on this one, I have something. But when it acts on that one, on the second one, I pull out an NK outside, and that will give me a zero when NK hits, is contracting with the projector. So I'm going to take it out from here and put it here. Sorry, put the NE and have grad F. NK. That's the only one, the only contribution that in the end doesn't give us a zero. We do the same thing. Now we write this as minus KF NK minus NF AK. has been multiplied by the projectors. The projectors, again, I see that this guy will kill this contribution because I have an RNF. And I just have NK, sorry, I said KFK times NE. That was sitting here. So I have again F and K. And now the projectors have an A and a C. Again, this is a purely spatial tensor. It lives on the three-dimensional hypersurface. These projectors are projecting that, so they just change indices because they don't give us anything else. So this is equal to minus NE KAC. OK, so why did I bother to look at this explicitly? Let me just point this out. So what we work out here, this GED is in this term. And what we work out here, which is the contribution of the projector that has the K and the E, which is this one, it tells us that this term will give us this kind of contribution plus a couple of other projectors, while the second term gives us this kind of contribution. And notice that what we're trying to do is take the difference between AB, the covariant derivatives first of A and then B, then and the minus B and then A. But notice that the second term, this one, A and B come in the fall in this way, which means that if I do the anti-symmetrization, this one will give us a zero. So the second term doesn't contribute. So this term, after we take the difference, gives us a zero here. This one, on the other hand, doesn't. So this one will survive because I have an A in here. And the B is sitting there. So I have to account for it. So now, let me put everything we have so far. I have four dA dB omega E. I have the following. Right. So the second term gives us, so this comes from the first term. This comes from the third term. We only analyze these with a couple of these projectors. I have to put the R projectors and bring this and take into account that one as well. OK, so this is another example of how you play around. So we don't know. This omega is any arbitrary omega. It's the only thing we require it to be a covector on the three on the hypersurface sigma. We don't know what the result of that is. But we do know that by construction, by definition, we chose this omega AE to be on, it's a dual vector on sigma. So I don't know what it is, but I can now play around with the derivatives. So this is equal to grad E of NE omega E minus omega E grad E of NE. Right? We just simply rewrite that derivative as the derivative of the product minus what is left over. And the reason I do this is because now this combination is zero. And E multiplying omega E, one is normal to the hypersurface, the other one is tangent to the hypersurface. So that's a zero. The other term, on the other hand, gives me now the covariant derivative of N. And we have expressions for that in terms of the extrinsic curvature. So that's what I'll use. Have minus omega E, and this one will be minus k dE minus nd and e. Right? This is using our expression for the covariant derivative of the vector n. Okay, but now we see, again, we have a projector here that contracts the index d, and we have it here as well, but that's a normal, it's a vector normal to the hypersurface, so that's also zero. So we kill that one. And so we're going to write right here. Let me write it. I'm going to complete this here. So I have a minus sign here, minus, minus. I'm going to have a net minus sign. We also see the projector dB is hitting a vector, a tensor that is purely spatial. So the only thing is we're going to change that to B. That's it. That's all we have. So now we can do what we wanted, which is to take this and subtract the same with the indices interchange. So we do. Omega E, we're almost done. We have H. Okay, so now we want to compare what we have here with what we have there. So first, let's look at this one. Notice that what we have done here is we have the anti-symmetrization between A and B. And it doesn't take long to convince oneself that if you have the anti-symmetrics on the index A and B, this is the same as changing the anti-symmetrization on the indices F and D. Right, so this is exactly the same as having done left A and B here and changed to D and F there. So then I can take that into account by removing this and this expressing a term that is subtracted with the indices sub change. So I want to do this. And remove this. And the reason we want to do that is because this we saw, or we started by tying it or giving to us the Riemann tensor on the three-dimensional hypersurface. But now we have the covariant derivatives as defined in the full four-dimensional manifold acting on a vector or on a covector that we're regarding as a full, as living in the full four-dimensional manifold. This will give us the Riemann in the four-dimensional that we will compute from the four-dimensional point of view, plus some extra stuff that has to do with the case. So the one thing we would have to be careful with is if we would have to, we would like to, if we want to tie the full four Riemann with a full three Riemann, we would need an R index, so we put an R projector, and the reason we can put projectors for free is omega only lives on the space like hypersurface, so I can always freely put an R projector here and we don't have to worry. So bottom line is then we can deduce the first of the Gauss-Kodaczky expressions that basically say the following, that the fully projected or the three-dimensional A, B, C, D. Well, I'm just writing it this way. The fully projected 4, and I'm putting the 4 here just to be kind of over clear on what we mean. So this is an expression that says, on the left, on the right-hand side, we have something that is purely spatial, right? This is the Riemann tensor that we would build from the intrinsic metric of the manifold sigma. Pieces that know about the extrinsic curvature, how this embedded, how this surface is embedded in the four-dimensional case, is equal to the spatial components of AB of the 4 Riemann tensor. So this is not the full information of the Riemann tensor. We're just saying the spatial part, the fully spatial part of the full Riemann tensor is related in this way to the intrinsic Riemann tensor plus extrinsic curvature components. So it's an exercise, is to show. And now, if you take the full 4 Riemann tensor and don't do a full projection on all indices, but you do it on 3, so you compute, you take R, say A, B, C, D, you multiply this by N. So we're projecting the first component along the vector N, and the rest fully projected. So all the R indices projected, so we have to put 3 projectors. This is equal to so this is much given kind of the exercise, and you saw how can we use the commutations to pull in derivatives N whenever we need to compute something that we don't have, and projectors who kill things that shouldn't contribute, we end up, oh, this is 0, sorry. Hold on. This is a D here. And this is D. This takes just a few lines to prove, and they're in the notes, they're there. Okay, so now what we're going to do is use this to motivate something we call constraints. So let's suppose we consider the following quantity. Again, we start with a full four-dimensional tensor. And we're going to hit it with these two tensors. So we raise the indices of the projector, AC, BD. And we want to know what the result of this is going to be. So let's see what it is. So this is going to be R, A, B, C, D. By definition, this was GAC plus NA and C. Right? So now we have 4 terms in here, but not all of them will contribute. When we have NA and C multiplying NB and D, and we hit R, what do we get? Anyone? So what is R, B, C, D? N A, N B, N C, N D.
0.
Right. So this is 0 because of the properties of the Riemann tensor. The Riemann tensor is antisymmetric in the first 2 couple indices, second couple indices, and we just need one of them. So A, B hitting N A and B gives us 0 by symmetry arguments. But we're going to have the R terms. We have G A C, G B D will give us something. That's the Ricci. The Ricci scalar, and the rest will give us right. So when GAB hits, when ER this or that hits this, gives us the two Ricci tensor, and then we just have the R vectors, and then we use symmetries to not realize that those two terms are the same. This, however, is equal to simply using the GAB, is RAB minus 1/2 GAB R. Right, so we can simply hit this by with N and relate GAB NA and B with these components. So what we have now is that if we take the Riemann tensor multiplied by these component, these projecting components, we relate to G, and this is how we get the first constraint. And I'm just, again, leave it as an extra simple exercise. Using this identity, just multiply by HAB, HAB, in this way, all right, the gamma AC and gamma BD, that one over there, to show that GAB NA and B is equal to 1/2. The Ricci scalar associated with a three, with a manifold, a three manifold, plus the trace of the extrinsic curvature square minus KAB, KAB. Okay, so we can discuss any general case, but let's imagine that for simplicity, we're in vacuum. So GAP is equal to zero. So what it's telling us is that this has to be satisfied if we're to satisfy Einstein's equation. So this is the first constraint. That says precisely 3 plus k squared minus KAB, KAB has to be equal to 0. Analogously, we can take this kind of contribution, obtain the right projections, and what we would get is the following. Is equal to zero. Of course, this is for a vacuum case. For a non-vacuum case, we'd have some sources. GAB is equal to a pi TAB, and so then they wouldn't be zero. There would be some terms. In particular, for instance, if we had some contribution in the energy, so if we define as a density, then what we have here would be something that says this is equal to the density or proportional to the density. And we can then discuss a few things. But in particular, let's suppose that K, or our hypersurface, is not changing very rapidly with respect to time, or it's not embedded in a very curved manner with respect to the four-dimensional one. Then the extrinsic curvature, and this we'll discuss later on in more detail, will be zero, so we'll have this equal to zero. Furthermore, we can imagine that our three metric is given by, say, essentially the flat metric times some function phi, some scalar field phi. If we put these ansatz in here, what we'll get to the leading order is Laplacian of this phi. And so this equation has this information. So Poisson equation is hidden in this one, and this is called the Hamiltonian constraint, and this is called the momentum constraint. So this will know if our energy has any given momentum, is just moving in some particular direction for the non-vacuum case. For the vacuum case, these are zero, and we'll be solving Laplacian phi equal to zero, subject to appropriate boundary conditions. So we're not done yet, because what we have so far obtained is that through our embedding, we can relate the full four-dimensional tensor completely projected to the hypersurface related to the three-dimensional Riemann tensor associated to that hypersurface and extrinsic curvatures. This is when we project it completely. When we project only one of them, we get this other one, which is the momentum constraint. We can ask the question, what happens if we project two of them? And we know that we cannot project arbitrarily. We can project this operation. Doesn't give us any new information because this one is identically zero by the symmetries. So the most we can do is that one, or contract with B and D, which is exactly the same answer due to the symmetries. So we can ask what this gives us, right? When we project two indices, the indices that we can along N, and the rest on the other directions. And what we get there is the following. Let me see how I want to present that. Well, before I do that, let me just remind you some property. So remember what the lead derivative along some given vector, let me call it n, is, right? So if I have a vector v, it would be nb grad b of na plus, va plus vb grad b of na. In the lead derivative, something that is perhaps not always stressed, one can have any derivative. So in particular, this is the same as so that's the first reminder. The second one is that one can prove very, very easily that if we have the lead derivative of a vector, along a vector, of some object that is purely spatial, and by S now it can be any tensor, it doesn't have to have any particular property, except that for this particular discussion, we might imagine that it's a completely covariant tensor. This is true. So if we take the action of the lead on this tensor that is of type 0L, we're assuming that the S is purely spatial, so it's also purely spatial. And we take the projection of the result that's equal to the lead derivative of that. So this is true for this case. We're thinking of a spatial tensor of type 0L. We take the lead derivative, we project it, it's equal to itself. We don't have to do any projection. The other property that is also easy to prove is that if we're given a vector n, if we multiply that vector n by any function f, then it is true that the lead derivative along the result of f multiplying by n of S is equal to F, the lead derivative along N of S. But what we'll argue now is that we consider one very special new vector. Ouch. Boy. Those two properties over there, we can, or especially the first one, we can extend it to any particular tensor. Oh, let me write here first. But suppose we consider a new vector n, let me call it Na, capital Na, which is equal to alpha, the Laplace function, times the normal that we define with respect to our hypersurface. The following is true. Again, that all these are very straightforward to prove. The lead derivative of along that vector, and it works along this vector, because it has to be multiplied by, it has to be the normal multiplied by alpha, of our projector is identically equal to zero. That means that when we take this particular vector, the flow along that vector leaves our projector unchanged. This is particularly useful because it says, OK, we work really hard to define these quantities with respect to this projector. We have this hypersurface. And this projection operator that we define is preserved by this flow. Furthermore, this result implies, now, what we said before, but for any tensor, so we have now this property that before it was only for spatial tensors of type 0L. Now it is true for any tensor, and it doesn't have to be spatial. Sorry, it has to be spatial, but any type. And we're going to use this property to define our evolution equations. The last thing we notice is that this vector so constructed multiplied by this natural normal to our hypersurface gives us 1. So there's a sense that along this n, if we try to evolve a little bit, we're computing the kind of the same amount of change with respect to this fiducial coordinate t along all possible points on the hypersurface. OK, and then this equation, which is the Minardi equation, is what we said before. The fully contracted, the fully projected result of having done, let's say, is equal to so I leave it as an exercise, prove this one. You can start first with, if you want, little n. And you see that only if you multiply by alpha do you have the right terms that will cancel at the end of the day and will give you this property. So now, again, let's assume with this is a true geometric identity, again, that relates the four or seeing our natural quantities on the three-dimensional manifold with respect to things that we can calculate in the four-dimensional manifold. And we can use this again, coupled to Einstein's equations, to deduce what the evolution equations would be for this object. And what we find is the following, that again, for vacuum. If we are not in vacuum, there would be some more terms here to know with the source. And again, the general discussion is in the notes. So we had this, and we also had the definition of the extrinsic curvature with respect to the leader derivative, right? Remember, we had the leader derivative along the vector n of the metric GAB was 1/2 KAB. We also remember how we define, well, let me just say, with respect to our coordinates, this vector n is equal to 1 over alpha TA minus beta A. This TA is just a flow along the time direction that we arbitrarily put in, and beta is the shift that we define. So we can further write this as Li T A minus Li beta A 1 over alpha T over alpha beta over alpha of K A B equal that, where we're using this now. We have this plus N. And we're also using, we can use this property, where the lapse is now any arbitrary function, so we can actually pull it out and have it multiplied. And so let me just write the final result. I'm going to remove this. Now I can simplify this alpha. That alpha stays. So that's what we have. And remember, I'm going to take the alpha, this alpha here. And the last thing we said is, remember, that first observation that the lead derivative can have the covariant derivatives or any derivative that we care about. So we might as well just use the simplest one we know. And so this will be dt of KAB minus the lead derivative along beta of KAB equal this right-hand side. So our final equations now, we can discuss that, is if we already have the constraints sitting over there. We have to add to this one, say dt of GAB minus the lead derivative along beta of GAB is equal to minus 2 KAB. That's the definition of the extrinsic curvature, and then that thing over there, so dt KAB equal that expression. So let's pause for a minute and discuss what we got. So we started with a full dimensional, four-dimensional Einstein's equations, RAB equal to 0. We know that four pieces of information should be freely specifiable. That those are the coordinates. We have re-encoded that information in alpha and beta. Somehow, at the end of the day, we're going to have to then give a prescription for alpha and beta. Okay, those are freely chosen, are related to the choice of coordinates that we can have. We can make them arbitrarily. We can re-transfer that information into these four quantities, alpha and the three components of beta. Somehow, we're going to have to give them, and this is something we're going to have to discuss later on. But let me discuss, let's assume for the moment that somehow we have those coordinates. Now we have the following. First, we have this kind of equation that says the time derivative of gamma is related to k. The time derivative of k is related to the curvature of the, that this surface realizes it's in, either because of its intrinsic curvature or because of its embedding with respect to the full four-dimensional space, and of course sources if we are talking about the non-vacuum case. So at least from the kinematical point of view, we have what we kind of predicted yesterday. The velocity of the metric, the intrinsic metric, is related to this quantity. And this quantity, this quantity's velocity is related to the curvature. So if we take the second time, another time derivative of this, we'll have a time derivative of that one. And then we can replace the result of this one in here, which says the acceleration of our hypersurface is related to the three curvature and the extrinsic curvature for the how it is embedded in the four-dimensional case. We can do a counting kind of game here. So I have, this is a fully three-dimensional metric. So it's a 3x3 matrix that is symmetric. So we have six pieces of information here. KAB is also symmetric. So we have a 3x3 matrix, again, six pieces of information total. Together, they have 12 unknowns. The gamma and the K forms 12 unknowns. However, we have, again, these constraints. These equations are not, the solution to these equations shouldn't be completely free. There are these relationships. The analogy with Maxwell's equations would be we have E dot equals something, curl of B, B dot minus curl of E, say. But in addition to that, we would have the divergence of E equals, say, the charges, and the vacuum would be divergence of E equals zero, and the monopole constraint, which says the divergence of B has to be equal to zero. So E and B cannot be freely evolving. They have to satisfy these constraints. The same thing happens here. These equations cannot have free independent solutions. They are tied by that. So we have four more pieces of information that we have to fix here. So if you want, if we play the game of counting again, so we notice that K, well, I can, with respect to the gamma, if I take it now time derivative, I have six pieces of information there, assuming that alpha and beta have been fixed somehow. We have four constraints. In the end, we end up having with two truly independent degrees of freedom, and this is the freedom that would be encoded in the graviton or the gravitational waves. So these are, we've worked really hard to obtain these equations in some sense. They're kind of messy. I have to give you some unfortunate news. This is a very bad system to evolve. And this is something we took us, the numerical relativity community, quite a while to realize. This system of equations have been used for decades before we actually realized that they were pretty much a piece of crap for reasons we'll discuss later on. This equation is perfectly, hyperbolic in the sense that information you give it in given hypersurface will propagate at some given speed, the speed of light, plus some possible coordinate speeds depending on how we choose this lapse and shift. And they're perfectly good when you're studying spherical problems, and for reasons we'll discuss later on. But when we try to discuss fully general problems, it turns out to be the case that these equations are of type weakly hyperbolic. This relates to this ill-postness statement that we defined the earlier, well-postness, that we require physical theories to have. The problem with this equation is that they are weakly hyperbolic, which means even a very simple scheme. So let me imagine that, let me just mention this in passing. So suppose we have this equation. That's just two advection equations. They couldn't be better and couldn't be a problem simpler than this. For reasons that we'll very slightly discuss later, if I now do this, we may have a potential problem. And then we'll discuss why. The reason that happens here is now perturbations that move at U can also affect B in such a way that the result of this problem generically will be that errors will grow linearly in time. And even departures at the analytical level, if you imagine that you put some little high-frequency perturbations, it will grow linearly with time. So that's not too bad, because we can tolerate linear with time growth. But if any of these equations had any arbitrary source, say something like this, one can prove that now the system is completely ill-posed. The very small perturbations will just grow without bounds. So weakly hyperbolic problems are not too bad, but when including nonlinear terms, they can really be problematic. And we have a whole set of nonlinear terms here, enough to cause all sorts of problems. Incidentally, weakly hyperbolic problems typically in physics mean maybe there is another combination of variables. Maybe there is a judicious choice of coordinates that will remove that problem. And that's precisely what happens with Einstein's equations. There are many ways of fixing, and by now there are several options out there that are perfectly well behaved. But these are things that we have to discuss. Another interesting side comment, astrophysicists have been seeing this for a long time, evolving the magneto-hydrodynamic equation. So we just try the evolution, say, of star that is magnetized, and you want to see what happens. They uncovered the problem, but then they created a solution for it, which is requires a lot of very complicated way at the numerical level. You could fix the problem at the analytical level by modifying the equation slightly. Like, again, let me imagine that we're dealing with, say, Maxwell's equation, and I have something like that. Nothing will change with respect to this equation if I add here, say, something like this. So I'm adding to Maxwell's equation something is identically equal to zero. Adding that term can be what precisely was needed to break the weakly hyperbolicity and make it all of a sudden something that is much more robust. And that would be this wording of strongly hyperbolic that people use. Again, so had they pulled out a trick like this, they wouldn't have had to worry or to work that hard on, at a numerical level to cure a problem. And the problem they are trying to cure is the weakly hyperbolicity is because of a term that is showing up that is proportional to the divergence of V. If you guarantee that the divergence of V is equal to zero throughout the computational domain, then you get rid of the problem. But typically, you may have a little bit of noise, and that's enough to kill things. Again, so now we know better. But just because we actually have to deal with the problem with in Einstein's equations, which was a lot more complicated than the simple fix that the or the simple but kind of messy fix that the astronomers have, astrophysicists have come up with. Okay, so just a few more things as well before we wrap up. So here we have put the formal equation. So say we're going to do even spherical symmetries for simplicity. I promise these equations are perfectly fine. We still have to deal with a few things. So first, let me just comment on how you're going to iterate the equations. Suppose we have the state of a system here, and we want the solution somewhere there. For the moment, let me imagine that we're not worrying about boundary conditions. Again, let me use the example of Maxwell's equations written this way. So suppose you give initial data here. We know that the constraints are telling us that E and B, or E is not, the different components of E are not completely independent because they're tied by this condition. The same goes true for B. We cannot give Bx and By and Bz independently because the divergence has to satisfy equal to zero. So suppose you give consistent data here to satisfy those equations. We want to evolve to the future. So one perhaps natural thing to say is to say, well, after having define things this way, I'm going to evolve using these equations. That gives me a recipe to go to the future. I have the time derivative equals sources that I know. Given that I know E and B initially, I can evaluate the right-hand sides, and I can evolve with E and B. But that's one option. You could choose to say, well, wait a minute. I'm going to evolve two of those components with this. And the third component, I'm going to impose this equation. So rather than using the three equations that are encoded here, you could use two of those and another one from here. The difference of that would be something that is called in one approach is called free evolution. And the other one is constrained evolution. Both are perfectly fine. Both are options that one can pursue, and both have their problems at the implementational level. So if you want to do constrained evolution, say you evolve two of those with this, then you're going to get the third one with this one. We need particular boundary conditions that may be very delicate. This is an equation where it will affect everything at the same time. This is kind of a elliptic equation in disguise, if you want, if you imagine that E is the gradient of some other field. So the boundary conditions are very delicate here. However, if we're doing this one, you're iterating the full evolution equations, and the boundaries take some time to propagate. The information at the boundary will take some time to propagate into the inside. Typically, in numerical relativity, this is where we are. And the reason we stay here is because to do this of solving a subset and then the other ones getting from the constraint will require us to somehow get out of here, these are constraints equations that are highly nonlinear, a particular piece of information that we can solve easily for. So typically, that's not what we pursue. But there are examples where really good physics have been extracted pursuing that approach in simplified settings where you can actually get a particular, say, variables out of here and solve for these ones. So that's one of the things I wanted to say. The other ones, so we haven't, as we have mentioned before, typically we are evolving with boundaries just because our computational domain has to be limited in size. So there are two options, say, that where people are mainly pursuing work nowadays. If it is asymptotic flatness, we're going to try to discuss boundary conditions that are as good as possible. And by that we mean the problem we're trying to solve does not have the boundaries. We have introduced them just to make a problem finite. We're going to try to do the cleanest possible boundary conditions we can, but in a constraint theory, theories with constraint, this is a very delicate thing to do in a physically meaningful manner or in a mathematical meaningful manner. And physically, we know that in curved spacetime, there is back reaction. A little wave, piece of wave that goes out, that's not really goes out transparently. As it's going, it's back scattering on the curvature of the spacetime. And this wave that is going like that generates a little wave that comes in. So if we try to put the boundary conditions we discussed that is perfectly transparent to things out, where we're saying nothing is coming in, we're actually missing a little piece of physics that should be there. And we don't know how to account for it correctly because we don't know the solution, the general solution of the problem. So no matter what we do, the best we can do is just do something that's mathematically consistent and physically approximate. But the boundary will be there. But one can always say, I'm going to be interested in the solution at some time, let's say here, and in this region, where if I look in the path domain of dependence, I shouldn't be able to touch the boundary. And if I am touching the boundary, then the next thing I do is I evolve it with a boundary further out and show that at that time, within this region, the solution hasn't been significantly affected. Okay, that's a strategy for this case. But of course, for this one, it's not. So there's a lot of incipient work that is starting this, and the ADS boundary is crucial in the physics. It actually provides this kind of contention inside a box of what the gravitational interactions may be. And doing something ad hoc that is not physically correct on the ADS boundary might completely kill the physics we're after. So this is just beginning to be investigated and will require it requires some much more delicate treatment than this one. The last thing, suppose you're in a spherical, in particular cases where you may have particular symmetries. So let me say, for instance, there's particular, for instance, spherical symmetry. One of these boundaries might correspond to r equals 0. So there is not really a boundary there. It's just a boundary that is fictitiously introduced by the coordinates that we have chosen. Going all the way to the boundary, we're going to require boundary conditions here because when you take derivatives, that point does not know what is on the other side. So here, typically what we do is just introduce regularity. In this case, regularity of the solution will allow us to come out with reasonable boundary conditions or physically meaningful boundary conditions for that problem. And we may discuss a little bit of that. In the web page, there is a set of notes that are explaining in detail one particular problem in spherical symmetry, which is that of the Einstein-Klein-Gordon system. This Einstein's equation is coupled to a Klein-Gordon system in details with all possible options that one may have and what has been understood. In particular, Chopik found this critical phenomena by looking at that particular problem. And the last thing that notice I haven't said anything yet is this. So the Laplace and shift and everything that I've been discussing, I was kind of putting aside and never saying a word. We're assuming that somehow some ultimate higher being tells us what the right recipe is. When we actually talk about a particular problem, we're going to have to worry about that. And different choices will create either will give us the right or a convenient way of to treat the problem, and others can completely kill us. So for instance, it's very tempting to say, well, I can choose the Laplacian shift very freely. Let me just choose the simplest one, alpha equal 1 and beta equal 0. This is our coordinates, whatever coordinates we use, are maintained as we move along. But we could be unlucky that our first hypersurface, we don't know what the real, what the theory is doing. We want to put some matter or some energy content and solve for the evolution. So let's say we have some matter in our spacetime. We put our initial hypersurface. That matter is curving the spacetime in a region. So let's say our initial hypersurface might be very nice, very, very far from the sources. And then it may do something like this. It may dip a little bit. And we say we're going to evolve with that one. Well, alpha equal 1, and actually more, beta equal 0 means we're evolving along the normal direction, right? So if the normal to this point goes like this, the normal to the point goes like that, and very quickly these two guys will meet, and we're going to have a coordinate singularity just because of an unfortunate or unfortunate choice of alpha of shift. So typically, we would not want this. We would want to choose a particular shift that's such that these kind of things do not happen. And there are a bunch of options out there, some geometrically or physically motivated, others more ad hoc, and by trial and error have been tailored to work the way we should like to. And the labs, the same thing. There might be situations where the dynamic is happening so fast that we would like to concentrate more hypersurface near that region to actually resolve it in a correct manner, or vice versa. There might be other situations where we actually want to speed up the evolution there just because nothing interesting is happening in that region. And the last thing, and this is I'm going to say, is about boundary conditions, which I just forgot. It's what happens when you have black holes. Okay, so physically we know black holes are such that if we are inside, nothing should be able to escape. So we shouldn't be given boundary conditions there, because what physically is happening is we're imagining the following. So let's say the black hole is somewhere in here. It's changing dynamically, it's growing dynamically. But anything that comes in into the black hole actually falls into the singularity. So if we have our boundary somewhere here, we can use explicitly, physically, that this is going on. And what we have, and this is something we'll discuss more next week when we discuss fluid dynamics, if a mode is actually going in that direction, we shouldn't be fixing any solution there, because the solution is fixed by what's trying to come from the outside. So just skewing our system, our discretization, just saying, OK, the derivative here will obtain with points to the right, that's physically meaningful. If we were not having it in this condition, if we try to do the same thing here, where there might be pieces going in and pieces out, and just only deform to the right, to the scheme in this direction, and not put any boundary conditions, then we'll see that generically this will go unstable, just because there is some piece of information that we're not accounting for. Well, here, all the information is automatically taken care of by the physics, because things should be falling in. Of course, we could have done things in such a way that the shift is just changing the coordinates so fast in the opposite direction that this doesn't realize. So sometimes we have to be careful that the physics is actually not being spoiled by a particularly bad choice of coordinates. And this, again, things are we're going to have to worry about, and we're going to discuss on a very superficial level some of these things. But I just wanted to give you guys a kind of an overview of things that once you have the equations, there's a lot more that you have to think about. And notice that in no way have I said anything about the numerical scheme that we're going to use. And the last thing, so this is what we're going to discuss later today. So after you are comfortable with the first RMPL kind of warm-up exercise, the goal of the first lab is for you to solve for the curve equation, for the curve box, this equation. This will be on a curved spacetime that is given by a black hole. We're going to be putting the boundary conditions. We're going to put our grid such that the inner point in the grid is inside a black hole. And we're doing that such that we don't have to worry about what boundary condition we have in there. It will be automatic. And then we'll be able to, once you have the project, you can change things and see that if you do something else, you may end up becoming something that is ill-behaved. but this is the goal of the project, that you get up to speed with these things, and then you begin to get some physics, interesting physics out. Any questions? No? Okay, then we'll meet this afternoon. Hopefully, if you have had problems, or if you are having problems with the warm-up exercise, please let me know. We're going to try to get you going with that as soon as possible so that you can move to the more interesting problems.